Bigfoot, the Loch Ness Monster, the Chupacabra, UFOs, aliens, Area 51, conspiracies, unsolved crimes, the supernatural. Are they real or are they figments? With your hosts, Colleen and Eddie Medina.
Hello and welcome to Figments, the podcast where we talk about the unknown and the unexplained. I'm your host, Eddie Medina, and with me tonight is the lovely Colleen Medina.
Hello.
And we're here, we're back week three of our month-long spooky cases for the month of October. And so we got a good one. Colleen, why don't you tell our listeners what we're going to be tackling tonight?
Oh, I'm so excited. We are going to talk about the infamous Amityville House.
Yeah, the grand poobah of all things haunted house related, the Amityville Horror.
The ultimate haunted house. When it comes to haunted houses, I think it's pretty swell.
When it comes to mass slayings of a family, it doesn't get much better than this. Wow, That's horrible.
Oh my!
I'm sure we lost a few listeners on that.
Okay, we lost one. We have one left.
Yeah. Right. Speaking of listeners, we like to give a shout out to Stu at the Midnight Movie Cowboys for giving Figments a little bit of love on the Midnight Movie Cowboys Facebook page.
Oh yeah!
Thanks, Stu. You're awesome, buddy. If you haven't checked out the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast, it is pretty awesome. I've been listening to it for a couple of years now. And you can find them on iTunes, so go subscribe and comment and give them a good rating because they deserve it. They're good guys. You can go to their website at midnightmoviecowboys.com. So definitely check out that podcast. It's good, good stuff. So let's get going on the Amityville Horror.
Sounds good.
Let's start off by taking it all the way back to the beginning. Let's go back to...
Taking it back.
Sorry, it's got... Rockified there for a minute.
We're very excited.
I know, right? Let's take it back before the actual haunting story. Actually, what precedes it is obviously the deaths of the DeFeo family. So, Colleen, I'm going to defer to you as the expert in all things Amityville.
What?
Right. So
all things Amityville. What? Yeah. Because I'm awesome. What?
Okay.
Okay.
So, why don't you get us started on that?
So, back in 1974, around, I guess it was November 13th.
That's right, lucky number 13.
Oh, I didn't even think about that.
Oh,
wow, crazy.
Gosh.
Ronald DeFeo Jr. rushes into his favorite bar in Amityville, New York, and is yelling that he needs help because his parents have been killed. And so everybody's freaking out and everything, and so they follow him to his house, and they realize that not only are his parents shot, but all of his siblings, his two brothers and his two sisters, are shot. So every member of his family has been killed except him. So he claims that, you know, he's being interviewed by the police, and he claims that he thinks that it was a mob hit because his family had ties with the mob somehow. And
yeah, he actually named mob hitman Louis Fellini as the culprit,
who turned out to have an alibi.
Yeah.
Later, it didn't take them long, as the police were investigating and interviewing him, his story just sounded suspicious. I think he was changing it a couple of times. And while they were looking around the house, they actually found the rifle box, the same rifle. It was a 35 caliber, what was it? Marlin?
Yeah, it's
Marlin rifle. They found that, I think, in his room, somewhere in the house, but I think it was his room, his closet, maybe.
But that was the box, the rifle box.
Yeah, the box.
Yeah.
That's what I said.
Yeah.
And so they thought, okay, well, I think he's the culprit. At first, when they arrested him, I think he was arrested just, a couple of days later than that?
No, it was the next day.
And
on the 14th.
He said, I think that's when he gave all these different stories. I mean, I think his story is still changing. He's 60 years old in prison now, because he was convicted, of course, and story's still changing, but he finally said that he admitted to doing it, and he said that once he started, he just couldn't stop.
Well, when they first arrested him, of course, the murders were on November 13th during the wee morning hours, and then he got dressed, went to work, worked his whole shift at the car dealership that his father owned or managed. I think they owned it. Yeah, because they had money, and went to the bar, apparently tried to call his family to check in on them as if he cared about them that much.
No one was answering.
Yeah, so then he left the bar to go check on them. That's when he rushed back in. So the next day when he was, you know, they realized something was... Well, they took him into custody because for his protection at first because of the mob hitman angle. And then they realized when they were interviewing him, the story kept changing, all the inconsistencies. And that's when they realized that he was, that, you know, that he was guilty. And he admitted to it. And that's when he started saying it was a demon that made him do it. It was demonic... Demonic voices in his head kept telling him. So he actually admitted to the murders fairly quickly. Now, he admitted to the murders, but like you said, his story has just changed and changed and changed. All the way up to like 2000 even, he gave like a different account to a book author. But we'll get into that in just a little bit. So yeah, it's just inconsistencies from the get-go.
Yeah, and so they discovered that each member of the family was lying face down in their bed, and the parents had both been shot twice in the back, and each sibling had been shot once in the back. And they discovered that the mom and the youngest daughter, Allison, had been awake at the time of the murder. They were wondering, well, you know, why were they all laying face down? And legend has it that the house is built on an Indian burial ground. Isn't that kind of a pattern with ghost stories, Indian burial ground?
Well, is that where they got the idea for poltergeist?
Probably.
You would have to think that they drew from it.
It's so common. It's like, is that haunted? Oh, yeah, it's built on an Indian burial ground.
Yeah.
But anyway, so they say that these Indians were buried face down so they would...
No, in their culture, they would bury their enemies face down.
Enemies face down, okay.
Yeah.
So that's why they think that all of the members of the DeFeo family were lying face down. I do kind of find it odd that they're all lying face down like that. I mean, I think with kids, it's typical to sleep like that. But with adults, especially older adults, I don't think that's a very typical, especially if you're a heavy set person. They thought that the bodies might have been moved, but they, doing all these tests, they realized they hadn't been. And then they're thinking, okay, well, he had to have had a silencer on his rifle because that rifle is known to be extremely loud. And even though the mom and sister were awake, no one got up. No neighbors heard anything when they were questioning neighbors. Nothing. Nothing was heard.
That particular rifle, when they were doing the investigation later, the police, you know, took a similar model and ran tests. Once they fired that rifle, they could hear it up to 4 blocks away. Four blocks. And the coroner obviously put the time of death the attack at 3:15 in the morning.
Right. Yeah.
And of course, like you were saying, there was no one heard any gunshots. One neighbor said that they were up at 3 o'clock, and they said between 3 and 3:30, all that they heard at that time was their dog barking at something. So they could hear the dog barking, but they never heard these gunshots that could be heard up to 4 blocks away, even though they were apparently right across the street or a couple of houses down.
Right. And ballistics say that he did not use a silencer on his rifle.
No.
So that's another part of the story that is confusing, is crazy that this rifle is so loud, but nobody heard anything. No family members got up to try to see what was going on. I mean, nobody sleeps that soundly. Come on.
But that's where, like, the paranormal part of it comes into play.
Right.
Because, okay, they're face down. They're all shot. No one is awakened by the gunshots. No one's stirred. And they say that it could be a possibility of paranormal activity because... And I don't know. I'm no expert in this sort of thing. But maybe what it is when there's paranormal activity, it creates like a sound vacuum. It could create a sound vacuum.
Oh my, okay.
I mean, we don't know how the spiritual world works. Whether or not DeFeo was possessed and was told to do it by demonic voices, obviously this dude is disturbed. Mm-hmm. Like, if he's making up that story, like, oh, the devil made me do it. He may be making up that story, but obviously there's something going on in this dude's life that he's probably being, you know, influenced by dark forces. So this is where we're going to get a little bit into the spiritual side of it. You know, we don't know how this works. If it is like dark forces and dark spirits, who knows what is capable of, if that's the case, if they're mute sounds so other people can't hear. It's just...
Yeah, I think that's part of it, that they think that if it was controlled by a demonic spirit, then it took care of the sounds. I mean, it kind of blows my mind, makes me really wonder about it, because how did nobody hear anything? And the house, you can't tell me the house is that soundproof. They were hearing the dog. I mean, the dog slept inside, I think, at the front door.
Yeah, when you saw the pictures of the neighborhood, the houses are fairly close to one another.
Yeah, they are.
That's how the investigators found the bodies, and very unusual. That's why there's some that say that he had help, and we're going to get into a couple of those theories here in a bit. Because, you know, if he had help, then it would stand to reason that would be why, if they carried out the murders simultaneously, different people, then that's why they didn't wake up. But maybe before we get into those theories of whether or not he worked alone or if he did this with others, you know, before we get into that, let's take it back a little bit further and talk about the DeFeo family, like their relationships and everything.
Yeah, they moved from, I believe, an apartment in Brooklyn and into their dream home at 112 Ocean Avenue. Mm-hmm. And they even erected a sign outside with the words High Hopes on the outside of it. Cute sign, cute house, cute garden. It had a pool, had a boathouse.
Yeah.
The only thing I didn't understand was why the color of the house was so dark. In the pictures, we can't tell if it's actually black with white trim or if it's just a dark color. But I always thought, even with the windows.
Yeah, infamous eye windows.
Looking the way they do, if the house wasn't dark like that, I don't think it would look as ominous.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But anyway, so they moved into their dream house, and we're hearing different stories. There's a few documentaries that we've heard, that we've seen, that people that actually knew the DeFeos did not know of anything going on out of the norm, out of the usual. No abuse, no loud yelling, anything like that. Everybody was getting along. Just, you know, the dad would invite the kids to come over and play, and they would swim in the swimming pool, and the little room that was not in the house plans that the Lutzes found, which I know I'm jumping ahead, but I have to jump ahead to go back. Hey, did you get that? This guy grown up said that as a kid, the dad, he had the kids, all the kids, paint that room, and to paint it red because that was the paint that he had, and they just stored their toys in it. There was nothing unusual, scary about it at all.
Who said this?
I don't remember his name, but he was in one of the documentaries that I have seen. He was the guy that is now grown up talking about it, and he even now gets choked up. He was one of the neighborhood children.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
And he will get choked up thinking about it because he was friends with those kids.
He was friends with the DeFeo family.
He enjoyed spending time over at their house. He enjoyed the parents.
Yeah.
He thought of them as, you know, close friends, even family.
Mm-hmm.
And so when he's hearing these stories, you know, Ronald DeFeo, Ronnie Butch, is claiming that there was abuse going on and coming up with all of these stories. And, of course, we don't know if these stories are true or not. And, unfortunately, the DeFeo family cannot defend themselves. We only have him to go by. So he's claiming that abuse was going on, and, you know, there's other people that have been around. But, you know, you're thinking, okay, if you're inviting someone over to your home, are you really going to show your true colors and be abusive to your family? You know, so it kind of, just because those people came over and had a good experience and didn't see anything out of the usual, doesn't mean that bad things weren't happening in that house.
And that's in relation to the father, like the claims that he was abusive and all. Now,
yeah.
Ronnie, that's a whole different story. He had a known reputation of being a bully, of abusing drugs, alcohol. With his story, it's completely different. I remember hearing an account of one of the neighbors who lived across the street, when they heard that there were murders that had occurred there at the house. He didn't even realize that Ronnie was a survivor. He just heard that there had been some murders at the house. And he said he immediately, when he heard about that he told the wife it was Ronnie. Not even knowing that Ronnie wasn't one of the ones who was murdered.
Like, that's crazy.
Because that's the type of reputation he had. I mean, this is a guy who was a known bully and didn't finish school. You know, he got kicked out of school, started using heroin, and was known for just terrorizing other kids, even kids who didn't even go to his school.
Yeah.
And so he was known to have a bad temper. Spoiled as all get out, because apparently he got whatever he wanted. Like, if he needed money, he'd ask the dad for money. The dad would give it to him. And apparently that was part of the thing where the parents failed, was because they were having trouble with Ronnie. They would often, just to kind of, you know, make him happy, so he would just kind of, you know, do his stupid things, they would just kind of give him what he wanted. So whether it was giving him money when he asked for it, the father gave him a boat, you know, to cruise up and down the lake that they lived on.
I think he gave him a car too, bought him a car.
Yeah, it was just all sorts of crazy things that they just were just giving this guy. So he was living a comfortable life. And despite all that, given the fact that he had material possessions, he was still just acting out and having problems.
Yeah, and he claims that there was one time it had started up, one time, I guess in the kitchen, the abuse with dad and the oldest daughter, Dawn. And so Ronnie got the rifle and he knew it was loaded, and he was thinking to himself, okay, I'm just going to have to kill him and to make this stop. And so he tries to fire the rifle and it doesn't go off. And the dad is thinking, okay, you know, he pointed that rifle at me and he was going to shoot me, you know, if that story is really true. So he was trying to get the dad to leave, I guess, to leave Dawn alone. I don't know what they were fighting about, who started it or what, but I guess in his mind, the dad was wrong and was kind of being a bully with Dawn.
Yeah, and the thing about that particular story is apparently afterwards, the father claimed that it was a miracle that happened, that the, you know, he pulled the trigger, the gun didn't fire, so it must have been a miracle. So apparently after that, the dad started hanging up religious artifacts around the house and in the yard.
Like, I thought that's when it was, yeah.
He kind of became a little bit overly obsessed, you know, with the fact that he could have died and didn't die.
Right.
So, yeah, that was a strange occurrence. And apparently, it didn't faze Ronnie in the least. Like, as the account was told to someone else, he pulled the trigger, it didn't go off, and instead of reacting like with remorse, like, oh my gosh, I almost killed my father, instead he went in the opposite direction, like no emotions, and just kind of lowered the gun and just walked out of the room like, oh, okay, it didn't work.
Yeah.
Just very strange.
Completely opposite of what you and I would do.
Yeah, or normal.
We wouldn't even be
do.
In that situation.
Yeah. Going back to the murders, one theory that's going around, now I don't know how much truth there is to these accusations, but it was said that Ronnie and his sister Dawn had an incestual relationship, and that they actually planned the murders together to carry them out together. And if that was the case, that would be a second person to have, you know, a hand at helping them carry out these murders, so simultaneously to where the other families couldn't wake up and react in time.
I wonder, did they plan, I mean, if that's true, did they plan that so they could kill their family and live together?
What was said was that the plan was to kill the parents, and which is odd because from what I understand, the mom, they shouldn't really have had anything against the mom, but I guess they figured if they killed the dad, they had to kill the mom. So what Ronnie said was that when Dawn killed the parents, she just lost all control and went and killed the siblings in order to not have any witnesses. And Ronnie was so, like, enraged with the fact that she killed the siblings, he hit her on the head, knocked her down, and then shot and killed her out of, like, anger that she did that. Now, the interesting thing that is, there actually could be some truth to that theory. There is a drug enforcement agent that contacted a journalist some time back and said that this drug enforcement agent had been surveilling the house because of Ronnie's drug use. This unnamed drug enforcement agent said he saw the sister Dawn leave the house that night with the rifle. She put the rifle in the back seat, drove it out to the dock on the point, which is where the police found the rifle later on, and I guess she disposed of it out at the dock. When they went to check her night clothes that she was wearing that night, they found unburned gunpowder on her clothes, suggesting that she had fired a gun.
Yeah, I've heard that. I didn't hear anything about somebody saw her.
Yeah.
What? I've heard something like that. I didn't hear that they had any sort of relationship. I'd heard years ago that it was actually Dawn and Ronnie. They were conspiring together to kill the parents. Whoever killed the parents, and then she killed the kids, mm-hmm. and he got so mad about that because that wasn't part of the plan, because they were innocent, that he killed her. Now, there was no, in what you said, whenever they did testing on all the bodies, of course, there was no indication of anyone having any injuries other than being shot. So he didn't, you know, hit her, unless a spiritual force covered that up as well. And then if he hit her and knocked her down, she just happened to land in her bed face down, you know?
Yeah. Sticking with the theory that Dawn helped him and he killed her out of rage for her killing the siblings, mm-hmm. The theory suggested that the grandfather, who apparently was also, you know, wealthy, and he wanted to save what good grace was still left of the name, of the family name.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to keep the ancestral relationship quiet, because he figured if that came out, then that's going to be one more thing attached to their family name.
Mm-hmm.
So they say that the grandfather convinced Ronnie to take the rap for all the murders, and Ronnie did so.
Oh,
just to kind of keep that part of the story a secret. Now, again, these are, the stories just change over and over, mm-hmm. from year to year. It's just ridiculous.
Crazier and crazier. I think the type of person that Ronnie was, I don't think that he would just take the blame like that, just in to keep the family name going.
Yeah,
because he had a good relationship with his mom. But rumor has it that the only relationship he had with his dad was a fired up one.
Yeah, yeah, always butting heads and everything.
Right.
Well, the story then changes again. I don't know if it's changed since this last time, but in November of 2000, Ronnie was being interviewed by author Rick Osuna, who wrote the book The Night the DeFeos Died.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that Ronnie told him that he committed the murders with Dawn and two unnamed friends. So the story changes yet again in 2000 to four people did it.
Yeah.
So Ronnie, his sister Dawn, and these two unnamed friends. So when they went to look into contacting these two friends to, you know, get their side of the story, apparently one had died in 2001, and the other went into witness protection program. So pretty much, it pretty much is just yet another lie to the story, because, like, how convenient that one is dead and the other's in witness protection.
Right.
It's just crazy. And another interesting thing with the deaths of the DeFeos, one theory was also that they were sedated, and that's why they didn't wake up with all the gunshots going on. But when they did the toxicology test on them, there was no drugs in their no sedatives in their system, so they weren't drugged. So here you have six people, and if it was just Ronnie working alone, which I believe it was, he's going first to the parents' bedroom,
mm-hmm.
fires two shots at the father, then two shots at the mother,
mm-hmm.
then goes up. Does he go up to one sister's bedroom first? Because I know he goes up.
I think he kills Allison and then the two boys and then Dawn.
So then, after the parents, so that's already four gunshots, mm-hmm. rifle shots that have gone off. Then he goes to Allison's room and fires a shot at her and kills her. So that's number five, bullet number five. Then he goes to the bedroom with the two boys and two more gunshots. So that's seven. And then finally to Dawn's room on the third floor and fires another shot. So that's eight. It's so odd. You had eight rifle shots go off, so far apart. No one wakes up, with the exception, they think, of Allison and the mother. They're all found face down. Investigators assumed when they arrived on the scene that they were moved into that position, but they came to realize they hadn't been moved.
You know,
there's just so many odd factors to their death. It's crazy.
Right. And I wonder if in 1973, testing wasn't as good back then as it is now. So I'm wondering...
74. Yeah.
Were they wrong about being moved?
Well, it's possible because, again, and oh my gosh, there's more inconsistencies in this thing than you would care to imagine. There was yet another investigator that testified saying that he believes that the bodies were moved. I don't think a whole lot went into investigating that aspect of the murders either. It was just, It's very odd. It was like there on the outside looking in, it looks like there was some sloppy police work that was done, but we don't know if that's the case. But it just almost appears that there's a possibility that it could have been.
Well, and I wonder too, if because it was in the early 70s, if the testing just didn't provide the accuracy that it does now.
The defense criminologist that said that he believes the bodies removed, that was Herman Reyes, R-E-Y-S. I had drawn blank for a minute, but so that's a name. If anybody wants to look up a little bit more information on that aspect of the investigation, they can. Very weird.
It is.
DeFeo, Ronnie DeFeo, they get into the court, you know, and his case was brought to trial. Trial started in October of 75. The defense tried to say that he was not, shouldn't be held accountable for the murders because he was crazy. Because...
He didn't know what he was doing at the time.
Yeah, which is odd. And he tried to play up the whole, I heard the demonic voices in my head. He claims he was handed the rifle by...
a pair of black hands.
A woman, a demonic woman, wearing a cloak with black hands. So it's just all these odd things. And they said he was acting very strange. And it was like he was trying to play up the whole, oh, look at me, I'm Looney Tunes, I'm crazy.
Right.
It's like he was overdoing it. And this is the weird thing. Years and years and years later, when they were talking to him about it, in his own stupid way, he kind of gave himself up that he was performing for the courtroom, because he said how he was trying to play it off was, well, there was even a priest in the courtroom at the time, and he even said about my performance that it was very obvious that I was being controlled by outside spiritual forces. And this is in an audio interview, and as I'm listening to it, I'm thinking, this dummy is actually calling it a performance. But he's saying it in the context of, oh, well, this priest saw my performance, and he was saying it was obvious I was being controlled by demonic possession. And I thought, oh my gosh, it's just, it's obvious the guy is guilty as all get out.
Yeah, I think he's guilty. He knew exactly what he was doing, and he knew enough to shower, change, go into work a full day, and then go to his favorite bar, call home, go home, come back to the bar and ask for help. And between all of that, he hid, let's see, didn't he throw the murder weapon in the canal, like right at the end of their...
It was like at the point, what they call the point, which is where this drug enforcement agent said that he saw Dawn take the rifle to.
And then he drove to somewhere and hid a bag of, I guess...
Oh, the clothes.
Like a pillowcase.
Or pillowcase, okay. Something like that. Something that had blood in it, that's right.
In a rain gutter or something like that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So I do not think that he was...
Well, the other part of it, just real quick, is they said that the way he was acting, people would say the way he was acting in the courtroom, it was almost like he was channeling his inner Charles Manson. Like, he was coming across, like, his body language, the way he was speaking, the way he was, like, real bug-eyed. They said he was acting like Charles Manson, and... you know, what was that would have been on everyone's mind at that time, because the Charles Manson, the murders and all that, the way he was being interviewed on TV, and people were seeing how he was acting. It's almost like DeFeo was just trying to do an impression of Charles Manson because he knew that's what people would expect a demon-possessed person to act like, you know.
Yeah, that's a good point.
It's just very odd.
I mean, I think he's crazy. Anyone who kills their entire family like that is somewhat crazy, but that doesn't mean that they don't know what they're doing.
Oh, of course, yeah. Yeah, he just thinks he's going to outsmart everybody by doing something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So think about this guy. This guy has been in jail for 42 years.
Yeah, just threw his life away.
42 years.
Mm-hmm.
Almost as long as you and I have been alive, this guy has been in jail. He's had all this time to just sit on the fact that he killed his family.
Mm-hmm.
And whether or not Don was in on it. And see, that's the other thing. Yet one more theory is that mm-hmm. they said in the condition he was in that night because of his drug and alcohol usage, that he was actually in no condition, they believe, to have carried out the murders. Now, that plays out in two ways. One, if that was the case, that he was not physically able to do it because of his drug use that night. One, Don could have been the one to do the murders.
Yeah.
And then when he came to his senses later in the early morning hours, that's when he freaked out and killed her for doing it. Or two, if you want to go the demonic possession route, if it was anybody else physically, they couldn't have done it. But if they are being possessed to do it, then that would almost stand to reason. Okay, physically, there's no way this guy could have even walked around the house, carried a rifle, fired this rifle. But if he was demon possessed, and they say demon possession can give someone superhuman strength and do all this, that, and the other, then there is that aspect, you know, to it. And honestly, this is just me personally as a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was definitely being influenced by demonic forces to do this murders, but I think he did the murders because he wanted to do the murders. He wanted to kill his parents and all.
Well, he had already tried, like I said.
Yeah, yeah.
And so those demonic forces just probably saw him as, ooh, let's get on to him and make him do something that he already wants to do.
There was obviously murder in his heart, and that's where the demonic forces could have fed off of. But as far as him being a mindless automaton, his body being used by a demon to do this against his will, yeah, there's no way.
He did have claims that the house, he was hearing noises in the house, voices.
Oh, and voices, yeah, that's
screams,
true.
Screams, nobody would be screaming.
That's right.
Not to the extent of the Lutzes, but he did claim that. Mm-hmm. Now, that's only coming out after, well, I don't necessarily know if he mentioned that after the Lutzes came out with their story or not, but again, he's the only one in the house that we can take his word for that heard any of that.
Yeah.
And everybody else that was there that went over there to play or whatever, being interviewed, never heard anything, never saw, heard anything unusual ever.
Yeah. So, I guess this would be a good point to segue into the Lutz family story.
Yeah, let's segue.
So, okay, so the house, how long was it vacant before the Lutzes moved in after the Fayos died? Wasn't it like within 2 years?
It was less than 2 years. It was around a year. So the DeFeos, all of their furniture, or at least most of their furniture, was left in the house
mm-hmm.
as part of the price of the house. And so when the Lutzes bought it, I mean, it was pretty much fully furnished house.
Not just furnished, but their possessions, a lot of their possessions were left as well. I'm sure like family members came and removed pictures and stuff like that. But from what I understand, that there was like the kids' toys were still there. There were still some clothes there and dishes and all. So it wasn't just like furniture. It mm-hmm. was actual their personal possessions.
Right.
Okay, so the Lutz family, you have the parents, George and Kathy.
Yeah.
Now, and there were three kids, correct? Two sons and a daughter?
Yes.
And they were all Kathy's kids. And so
mm-hmm.
George was the stepdad.
Yeah, he adopted them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I believe they were pretty much newlyweds.
Yeah.
Looking for a home that they could grow in. And the realtor showed them this home. And
it had everything they were looking for.
Yeah.
And then some.
They walked in and just fell in love with the house. You know, 6-bedroom. There was four. Let's see. No, 5 of them, I can't add. 5 of them, 3 kids, and this house was a 6-bedroom house. It had a full basement.
Had
a pool. It had a boathouse.
Boathouse, sorry, yeah.
Covered garage, you know, access to the canal there. Really, their dream house. And I think Kathy, when she talks about how she really liked the sign in front of the house, to the side of the house, High Hopes, because she felt the same way. She felt like that was their dream house, and they really had high hopes for their lives there.
Yeah, they got the house for $80,000,
right,
which was a steal, apparently, which was another factor. They thought, man, how can we pass up this house for that price?
Yeah, I think George, back then, he said that the house should have been something like $250,000. So oh, that's wow. back in the 70s, of course. That can put in perspective there.
Yeah, yeah. So they moved into the house, and of course, unbeknownst to... Oh, well, I'm jumping ahead. The realtor, once they fell in love with the house, right. and they were like, oh, this is what we want. Right. Then the realtor told mm-hmm. them about the DeFeo murders, which is... I guess they must not have been from that area, because I was thinking, wouldn't they have known? Surely they would have heard the story, but they must have been from somewhere else to not have known that story.
Yeah, and they talked about, would that hinder our ability to be able to live here peacefully?
Yeah.
They were like, no, I think we can do it. You know, that's in the past, and, you know, they didn't really have any thoughts of hauntings or anything like that. They just thought, you know, it's a tragedy, it's horrible, but mm-hmm. this is a new beginning for us, and so here we go.
So, and of course, unbeknownst to them, they move in. They were only going to be there 28 days.
28 days. Isn't there a movie called 28 Days?
28 Days Later, yeah. Could you imagine what had to have gone on, how extreme it had to be that they actually moved out in 28 days? Okay, let's...
I know, 28 days. So they moved...
Well, let's approach this two ways. Let's first tell their account. First, like, you know, how they moved in and what some of the things they experienced. And we could talk about after that how people think it's a hoax. So they move in. They didn't start experiencing stuff right away, did they? Because it was around Christmas time?
Yeah, I don't think so. I don't think it was right away, because they moved in a little bit, I guess, before Christmas. And Kathy was talking about during Christmas time, that's what they were experiencing. The Christmas joy, the Christmas sounds, Christmas music, all of that. And it seems like whenever they started being done with Christmas, taking stuff down is when, and it almost like whenever she's talking, she's attributing that to, we're taking this holy holiday down, so now the evil spirits can come out, mm-hmm. something like that.
Not to like badmouth either one of them, but sometimes when you listen to their accounts, these old accounts, when they're telling the story, it comes across very odd. Like the way she tells the story, she's like, oh, the sounds of Christmas were replaced with these other uncomfortable sounds. And all the while you're thinking, what? What sounds? What specific? It's like when they're telling their accounts, a lot of times they're not giving anything specific. It's very general sounding. But I think I'm kind of jumping ahead because I've heard so many of their accounts lately.
Well, they first moved in, it looks like, on December 18th. I knew it was pretty close, right before Christmas. I believe someone suggested that they have a priest bless the house because of the murders that happened.
Okay, that happened right away.
And so George called on the only priest that he knew of, Father Pecoraro. And
I thought you were going to say Peckerwood.
Really, you're playing around with a priest's name?
Oh, they're just people.
So he comes over and he's blessing the house, and this happens in the sewing room on the second floor, that he experiences extremely, extremely coldness. And he thought, okay, well, outside, I know it's wintertime, but it's not cold like this. This is way too cold.
Yeah, they said it was like a nice winter day.
It was a nice day. It wasn't a, yeah. And so then he hears a voice yelling at him to get out.
Mm-hmm.
And he says that he gets a slap in the face. Someone slaps him in the face, mm-hmm. but no one's there.
Mm-hmm.
So he suggests to George and Kathy that no one spend a whole lot of time in that room.
But he didn't tell them at the time what had happened. He just made the suggestion. So he didn't actually tell them.
Right. I would have been like, why? What did you see? What did you hear? What happened?
He just gave them the suggestion, don't sleep in that room.
Do not use this as a bedroom, and do not spend a lot of time in this room.
It's so weird.
Mm-hmm. And I believe the fly incident in the movie that get all over the priest, that did not really happen, but the Lutzes did find in that room, did continue to find flies constantly. Like they would clean them up, and there would be more flies, and there would be more flies, and there would be more flies. And they especially found it odd that it was wintertime and they're finding all these flies.
Yeah, I was going to say that's even more odd, the fact that it was happening during the winter.
Right.
Well, so that happened. So the blessing didn't even go off well, but
no.
with the priest not fessing up to them what he experienced, you know, they go the next few days through the Christmas season thinking everything's just fine, and once Christmas is over, that's when they start experiencing stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They say, Kathy said that she became very lethargic, like not really attributing it at the time to like maybe this dark spiritual force that was hovering over their family in the house.
Right.
She just became unusually lethargic, not wanting to do anything, not even wanting to do basic things around the house, mm-hmm. like cook and clean. She just
right.
didn't want to do anything. And George couldn't stay warm.
Right.
They said he became, and that was shown in the movie. I know we're jumping between fact mm-hmm. and fiction, but you know, they showed that in the movie too, where he was constantly building a fire to stay warm.
He was obsessed
warm.
with cutting the wood.
Yeah.
And he always had an axe. And so it became creepier and creepier because he kept getting these creepier looks on his face, like he was getting more possessed. Mm-hmm. And he was constantly cutting wood because he was trying to keep the house warm, the fire.
Yeah. And things would happen, like they would be in bed, and George said he would hear the front door slam,
mm-hmm.
jump out of bed, he'd run downstairs, he'd get to the landing, realize the front door's locked, and the dog is asleep in front of the door.
Yeah.
And so he's like, okay, that's strange. Another time, he said he heard what could only be described as a marching band downstairs,
mm-hmm.
like several feet walking around, shuffling about. He said, again, he runs down to check to see what all this commotion is downstairs, and nothing. Dog
right.
asleep again. So it's like he's hearing all of this stuff going on.
They also try to bless their... No, not bless. They try to perform their own exorcism, I believe.
Well, no, not exorcism, but like a bless. They try to bless the house themselves.
Okay.
By opening
it was
all
a blessing.
The windows. They opened all the windows in the house, and they would go to each room and say the Lord's Prayer in each room.
And they heard a chorus. They describe it as a chorus of voices telling them to get out, or would you just leave, or something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, to stop it, and yeah, try and like get at them. Also, they had claims of their water turning black, which,
mm-hmm.
again, that's a paranormal thing that sometimes is brought up in some of these haunting cases.
And George said that the water didn't turn black. It was the porcelain toilet bowls, actually, that turned black. So, was
it... porcelain?
The porcelain bowls that turned black. So, was it a reaction from their toilet cleaner to the water or the sewer line? You know, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know about that.
Also, the little girl, Missy, had an imaginary friend. This is the big one.
Yeah.
Jody, who she described as like a pig.
Mm-hmm.
And she could, the imaginary friend could change shape and all. One time, the mom saw like red eyes through the bedroom, through Missy's bedroom window, like peering on the outside. She was on the inside of the window, saw them on the outside. And then Daniel, the oldest son,
mm-hmm.
he claims that he and the dad were at the boathouse.
Yeah.
That's also where they had the dog's pen. So they were in that area. And they looked up at Missy's room. You could tell that he knows it's going to sound ridiculous when he starts talking.
Yeah.
But he says it's like a comical version of a pig. Almost like maybe whichever one is the pig and the warthog and Timon or Pumbaa. Which one is it Pumbaa?
Pumbaa, yeah, I think.
Almost like it's him standing up there mm-hmm. looking out her window.
Yeah.
And so they both just stop what they're doing and they rush up there to find Missy asleep in bed, but then her rocking chair is just rocking away.
He actually describes it in the words of a cartoon character of an angry pig with wolf teeth.
Yeah.
That's the words that he used to describe it. You know, you were talking about the boathouse. That was another incident where they said the boathouse door, it would just started slamming, opening and slamming,
right.
slamming, and it
mm-hmm.
freaked the dog out, and the dog tried to jump out of the pen
mm-hmm.
and nearly hung himself.
Right, trying to get away.
Trying to get away, and they yeah. had to, like, you know, go and rescue the dog from strangling himself.
Mm-hmm.
All sorts of crazy things. They also, you bring up Daniel, he said that he felt that claims that he was possessed. He said one time, I guess it was during an argument, because they said the family overall became very aggressive with one another during the 28 days.
Yeah, he claims that George was abusive.
Yeah, we can get into the George thing in just a bit, but he said in the course of these 28 days, they kept getting more and more agitated at one another, and I guess right. It was during one of the fights between him and George, he felt he became possessed, and his body was thrown up the stairs and against the wall. Not down the stairs. He said his body was actually thrown up the stairs and against the wall, and that his mom was behind him when it happened, and of course that freaked Kathy out to no end.
Right.
And he said he could only describe the feeling of possession as being numb, and he said he could hear like a gargling type of voice saying, "It is you." Yeah, so this voice saying, "It is you," as if you're the one I'm choosing to possess and carry out my bidding, I suppose. I don't know what
you're
that
doing
means.
It.
I don't know what that means, "It is you." Mm-hmm. But he said that even after the incident ended, the whole Amityville thing ended and they left the house and they tried to start a new life, he said that the Catholic school that he went to, Daniel, the son, went to after this incident, that he was claimed that he was still possessed. So the priest at this Catholic school would perform exorcisms on Daniel for the next year to help him get past it.
That seems a bit extreme.
Isn't that weird? Again, we're starting to get into these accounts where they're very, very hard to imagine if they were true or not.
I would think, wouldn't he just need therapy, talking, counseling, and not exorcism?
Yeah, perform exorcism on him for a whole year after the fact.
Well, Daniel also claims that he got his hand slammed in a window. The window, I believe in the movie, the window shatters. In real life, the window never shattered. I don't know if that's the same time or not, but the window slams down on his hand, on his fingers, and he describes it as skin to skin. What that means is he's saying that pretty much it just crushed everything, where it was like the skin on top was touching the skin on bottom, and then it healed itself. It healed itself.
Wait, what?
But now he, in his documentary, he will point to, he'll show you his hand like it. They're still a little mangled, but I don't really remember them looking, all that messed up.
Wow.
So that's pretty crazy.
So with George, he claimed that George was abusive, and George being abusive is the reason why Daniel left at the age of 15, and that he now claims that George is the one that triggered these hauntings because George was into the occult. So yes, Daniel Lutz claimed,
right,
as an adult, after all these years, claimed that George, his stepfather, was into the occult, and that's what started all the hauntings. Now, there's a few things about that particular thing. Number one, if George really was into the occult and Daniel knew it, then why in the world would he corroborate his account all of these years? If this was a man he knew was responsible for them and he despised the guy because he was abusive, if he hated the guy because he was abusive, why would he corroborate his account of the hauntings and cover up the fact that he was into the occult all these years until, lo and behold, he's an adult now. Now he's saying this.
Well, because I don't think he wanted to talk about it until recently.
Oh, yeah?
I don't think he wanted to talk about it at all. And you can tell even now he doesn't want to talk about it. And his documentary, he even kind of gets on to the lady that's interviewing him, because she just immediately starts asking him these questions and starts pushing him here and there, and he's like, okay, you got to back up and let me start asking you, so I think he's just having a hard time dealing with it.
Is he like an angry individual? I haven't seen the documentary, but you have. I've seen snippets of it here and there.
He seems like he still kind of has a chip on his shoulder.
Yeah,
I think if it wasn't true, especially with his claims of George dabbling in the occult like that, I think that he would, come out and say that it didn't happen. But he claims that all of that happened, and then to say that George was dabbling in the occult.
Okay. Seems very strange to me.
Well, and even Kathy, I hadn't heard her say this until just recently. She said that they were doing, what does she say, transcendental meditation?
Yeah.
So she even said that maybe we brought it on ourselves.
Oh, I never heard of that.
I didn't hear it until just really recently that she said that.
Huh, interesting.
Mm-hmm. Because you have to wonder, no other instances have happened since, you know?
Yeah, and that's what I was going to say, is if in fact George was into the occult and he is the one that triggered these hauntings, if you were to step back and look at it from that point of view, it almost makes sense that once the Lutz family left, once George was removed from that situation and he was the reason the hauntings happened, then it would make sense why they stopped after he left, because there's been 4 if not more families that have lived there since the Lutzes, and none of them have had any paranormal experiences in the house,
right?
So it's just odd, is the whole thing. Of course, they flee the house, and people start saying, after it hits the public, the story goes public, and the news gets involved, and paranormal investigators want to look into it and all, people immediately start saying it's a hoax. They did it for publicity purposes. And the thing with that is, they didn't really get a whole lot out of the deal to make it worth their while to have this be a hoax.
No.
Does that make sense?
They didn't make any money at all.
Well, no. I mean, they did, but it really wasn't for the amount that they made. You kind of wonder, was it worth the fact that they lost the house and all their possessions? They apparently got $300,000 for the story rights. But you stop and think, well, shoot, they got $300,000. But in the grand scheme of things, that's not a whole lot of money, considering the fact that the movie came out later and was a big hit. The book was a big seller. So they're not seeing any of that residuals from any of that other stuff. They got their paycheck and they were done. And
well, yeah, look at, I know they bought the house cheap, but that was their dream house, and they're going to give it up for 28 days. They paid $80,000 for it. George said that I think you have to add on like $400 to that, and then whenever they left it to the state, I guess, when
bank.
It was said and done, yeah, the bank, they got like $2,500 from it.
Oh wow,
that was it. So why would you make all of that up to get $2,500 from your house?
That's crazy. Not to mention the possessions that they left behind.
Well, the last night, they don't like to talk about what happened the last night
that they
were there, the final night. They have talked about it, but they don't.
It's in the book?
I believe it's in the book. You know, it's the version of it is in the movie, but they don't like to, like, whenever they're being interviewed, that's the part that they won't keep talking about.
The only thing I can remember about the last night that I remember hearing was Kathy saying that her and the 2 boys were lifted up in the bed. Like the bed actually physically
levitated yeah.
up with mm-hmm. them in the bed. It's crazy.
And I can't remember if that the last night was when George saw her transform into an old lady.
Oh, that's the other thing. That's
was
right.
Was that the last night?
Well, I don't know if it's the last night, but I think it was over the course of those 28 days that he was...
Well, yeah, it was. But she stayed an old lady for a while.
That's right. No, you're right. It was like it happened on the last night, and it took it a while for it mm-hmm. to kind of wear off, if that even makes sense.
And going backwards, I think one of the first things that they saw, I think it began in January, Kathy sat down in front of the fire, and she looked over and saw a cloaked demonic face come out of the fire. I think that was one of the first things that, because she had just put one of the kids to bed. It was like after midnight, I guess, on New Year's Day or whatever.
I think George was the one that most of the things, you know, this is kind of reflected in the movies. George is the one that most of the things happened to. Like, he was like the main person being haunted or experiencing these things, whether it's the noises and all. And what was strange is he claimed that they were always happen at 3:15, the time of the DeFeo murders.
Mm-hmm.
That he would be fast asleep and would immediately wake up at 3:15 to something happening. And so, again, there's that connection to the DeFeo family. And when the investigation started after the fact, after they fled, and Ed and Lorraine Warren came in to investigate,
yeah,
they even said themselves that things would happen right at about the 3:15 mark with their investigations too, apparently.
Yeah, I think so.
And it was also the Warren's photographer that took that picture that has the little boy peering out of the doorway, which mm-hmm. they believe is John Matthew DeFeo, the son.
Some people think it's the little one, some people think it's the middle one.
The fact that Ed and Lorraine Warren kind of gave their seal of approval on this as being like an authentic haunting. That part kind of makes me, that catches my attention, makes me wonder if it really, there is legitimately a real story here.
Lorraine still talks about that house as being so haunted. And she said in an interview, that's as close to hell, whenever they were there going through the house, she says, that's as close to hell as I ever want to get.
Yeah, and they even put that line in The Conjuring 2. Because, you know, for those who haven't seen The Conjuring 2, this doesn't spoil much. It starts off with the Amityville investigation, which is pretty cool that they started it that way.
Yeah.
You see those famous windows.
And what I think is neat is Daniel Lutz is still friends with Lorraine Warren.
That's right.
And was with Ed, too, until he passed away.
Yeah.
But actually was visiting Lorraine at her home, and they were talking about everything. So I thought that was neat. She probably helped that little boy more than anybody else could have.
It's so weird how history repeats itself. You go back to the DeFeo family, and there was just conflict between Ronnie and his father. And then you flash forward to the Lutz family, and according to Daniel, there was problems between him and George. It is strange that there's similarities on both ends. Now, all that being said, could there really have been some sort of demonic force at work in both the DeFeo case and the Lutz case?
I think so. Absolutely.
If you do believe in the spiritual world, and you do believe that there's more to just us, the physical world that we can see and touch, then of course anything is possible. And if you believe that there are, you know, there is good and there's evil, there's God, there's the devil, there's angels, there's demons, then you can guarantee that it is well within the realm of possibility that demons could have been at work in both the DeFeo case and the Lutz case.
Well, and people will argue, well, if that's the case, then how come the people that had lived in the house after the Lutzes didn't ever encounter anything?
Now, who knows?
My thing is, just because you're in the same house doesn't mean anything.
Sure.
It depends on you, your lifestyle.
Sure.
You know, let's look at the DeFeos. There's Ronnie, who was completely messed up. And if that abuse was going on in the house, then you've got all of that anger. Mm-hmm. And you're just opening up a possibility there. And if Ronnie already had tendencies to murder, then those demons are just going to jump on him like flies.
Yeah, they're going to feed off of that.
And then you've got the Lutzes, who are, you know, moving into this house, and I know people were murdered there. But if George Lutz was dabbling in something that he shouldn't have been dabbling into, then that was probably opening up the possibility there.
Well, something I just learned from you tonight on this podcast is Kathy herself saying that by doing transcendental meditation, maybe they opened themselves up to something they shouldn't have opened themselves up to.
Exactly. She's saying it herself.
Yeah.
And, you know, with Daniel saying that he's into all of that. So I think that explains it right there. So the people afterwards, they're just trying to live a normal life. They're not dabbling into anything that they're not supposed to. They're not opening themselves up. Mm-hmm. They're living a peaceful, calm, normal, somewhat life, and life goes on. Now, I do have to say that even though the house has been renovated, it's gorgeous, it's not dark anymore, it's like a cream color with white trim, and the eye windows have been changed to just regular windows. But I do think that the pool has been filled in.
Oh, yeah?
That is a tragedy in itself.
Oh, gosh, really?
I mean, come on. I have nightmares that our backyard has a pool that's been filled in. That's a nightmare for me.
Yeah, I wouldn't share that with people publicly. That's just crazy talk there.
Okay.
But it is interesting that an interesting side fact about the house itself, since the one connecting thing in all this is the Amityville house itself. During all this, the address, Colleen, is...
The address is 112 Ocean Avenue.
Now, since then, it has been changed for obvious reasons. It is now 108 Ocean Avenue.
And I knew that, too.
You did not.
I did. I was going to say it. but you had to beat me to it. And I hope everyone is listening out there that he is beating me to pretty much everything tonight, trying to say everything before I get there. Yeah, yeah, you noticed it too, I know.
Whatever. And another interesting thing is the DeFeos, I'm sorry, not the DeFeos, the Lutzes bought their house for $80,000 in what we think is, what, 1975, 76?
Somewhere around there,
76
yeah.
maybe. They bought it for $80,000. It went up on the market in June of this year, June 2016.
$1.5
million. $850,000. So you can live in the Amityville house for $850,000. It's just, it's odd because it's almost like they bought it for $80,000. And, uh-huh. and now it's going up for roughly $800,000.
I actually think the last listing is $1.5 million.
Yeah, that was the previous. It was sold for $1.5 million in 2010.
Oh, okay.
This is in this year.
It's gone down some.
It has gone down, yeah. Hmm. So it was last sold in 2010. So yeah,
you know more than I thought you did.
I know, right? It is a long, sordid history with the Amityville house. Amityville coming from the word friendship, because they wanted what was it the townsfolk wanted when they named it Amityville? They wanted to invoke the whole
friends.
God.
Well, I mean, let's not forget Mayor Vaughn. Amity means friendship, you know.
Okay. I knew at some point in this podcast Jaws was going to get invoked.
Of course, it's too close to Jaws.
Somehow.
It's not too far from the car.
Not too far from the car. And with that, let's far away from here.
I hope everybody enjoyed tonight's podcast. I know we've had fun investigating it and watching our documentaries.
Yeah, definitely. And once again, make sure you check out our friends, the Midnight Movie Cowboys, at midnightmoviecowboys.com. Find them on iTunes. So definitely check them out. Thanks again, Stu, for showing the podcast a little bit of love. With that, Colleen, do you want to take us out?
Where are we going? Can we have Mexican food or Thai? Or, okay. Well, all I'm going to say is, when you're hearing those gunshots going off.
Oh, gosh. Here we go.
And you're crying because the pool has been filled in. Ask yourself this. Are those sounds and cries real, or are they figments? Good night, folks.
Good night, everybody.
Figments is a production of EdMed Art Studios and hosted by the Jedi Cole Universe. You can find us at www.jedicole.com and www.eddiemedina.com. Thank you for listening, and keep searching for the unknown.